This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Film Spotting SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on Cable, bringing the latest indie movies into your home at the touch of a button.
Reese Witherspoon helps a group of Sudanese refugees adjust to modern life in The Good Lie. Scott Foley stars in and directs Let's Kill Ward's Wife, about the complications that arise when Ward's wife dies. Both movies are available now on demand.
The latest independent films are ready when you are with Movies on Demand on Cable. The Art House is now in your house.
From New York City, this is Film Spotting, streaming video unit. I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. And coming up on the show, Matt and I will make you feel deeply uncomfortable about spending so much time on your iPhone as we review the deeply cynical sci-fi anthology series Black Mirror.
Later in the show, we'll bring you cue shots where we recommend some other titles you can rent or stream at home right now, all centered on a common theme. And in honor of Black Mirror, we thought this episode should have a twist. Like we spend the entire show recommending M. Night Shyamalan movies, and then surprise! At the end, we actually reveal none of these movies are actually available for streaming, and then surprise! We made up Shyamalan movies. These Shyamalan movies didn't even exist. And then surprise! We wasted an hour of your time on absolutely nothing. And then surprise! You'll never get that hour back, and life is precious, and will soon be gone forever. Yeah, we gave some thought to that plan and then decided, maybe it's better not to waste you, the listener's time, for the sake of a terrible joke. So instead, we're going to recommend some movies about the fear of technology, technophobia, to those in the biz, and I'll probably make some terrible jokes along the way anyway. But first up is Opening Break, a segment we do in conjunction with our sponsor, Movies on Demand on Cable, in which we spotlight a few notable films new on demand. Allison, what are our picks this week?
Well, I have three movies, and they are all now available on demand. The first one is Calvary, which is the second film from writer-director John Michael McDonough, whose brother is also a filmmaker and a playwright, Martin McDonough, who did Seven Psychopaths and In Bruges. John Michael McDonough's first film was the very enjoyable The Guard, and Calvary finds him re-teaming with his star from that film, Brendan Gleeson, in what really feels like the role of a lifetime for Gleeson. He's terrific in this. He plays Father James, who is a priest in a remote coastal village in Ireland, and someone who came to his religious calling later in life after the death of his wife. And he's a good priest and a good man, and the film deals in these very blackly comic ways often with just how much he is able to give and accomplish with that in a world that can be a dark and difficult place, and one in which people don't think of and trust the church in the same way. The movie actually starts off with a man telling Father James about how he was sexually abused by a priest as a child, and that now, in a week, he's going to come and kill Father James as revenge, with the idea that killing a good priest will be even more hurtful to the Catholic Church.
Is everything all right?
Everything's fine. I mean, no, everything's not fine. Mass on Sunday? With the shades and everything?
Oh, that.
Yes, that. Are you laying into her, or what's going on? That wasn't me, though. No, no, that's that black fella that she's been seeing. I mean, the current fella she's been seeing. Sorry, I didn't mean to be racist there. That was a slip of the tongue.
You're saying he beats her up?
Don't quote me on it, but that's what I'm assuming. Yeah. I mean, she speaks in riddles half of the time. I can't make any sense out of her. I think she's bipolar. Or lactose intolerant. One of the two. I don't know where I am with her anymore, Father. And if I'm honest with you, I'm kind of glad to have her off my hands.
Even if this new fella's knocking her about?
But what's that to do with me?
What?
Not everyone can carry the weight of the world.
It's got some great supporting cast, including Chris O'Dowd as a local butcher whose wife is cheating on him and who may or may not be abusing her. And Kelly Riley as Father James's daughter who visits him after a suicide attempt. But it's Gleason who is really the heart and soul of this movie, and he's just salty and funny and certainly no saint, and is this really great and complex embodiment of faith in a way that you rarely get in films. You know, so many times in films when someone is religious, it's either in the context of a faith-based film that is specifically, you know, about speaking to people about their religion, or it's used to show hypocrisy or extremism. There are very few films in which faith is portrayed as this positive thing, if also a very complicated thing. So, and that's, it's a very good film, and I liked it a lot, and it is now available on demand, as is Art and Craft, which is a documentary that premiered at Tribeca this year, and is a really fun one. It's about Mark Landis, who seemingly compulsively forges artwork, not for profit. He doesn't sell it. Instead, he then poses as a kind of the relative of a wealthy person or representing an estate, and then donates it to different universities and museums. He doesn't want to make money. Instead, he wants to have the kind of pleasure of having fooled people and having had this thing that he made be taken into this collection as authentic, maybe even displayed. And he's very skilled at it, and he fools a lot of people, in part also because who would ever think that that something that's being donated would be not authentic? You know, it's not the same thing as trying to have it auctioned off. So Mark is also this fascinating character, this very eccentric character. And then you have Matthew Leninger, who is a man who was like someone he duped. I think he was working at a university, and who has since become kind of obsessed with him in terms of catching him and exposing him. And turns out to be, what the more you learn about him, the more weird he seems. And so after a while, they both seem like obsessive characters. So there's a little bit of Catch Me If You Can to this, but there's also, Mark Landis seems like a Tennessee Williams character. He really is, he's a standout in terms of the nonfiction world, in terms of subjects. So that's Art and Craft. And finally, also now available on demand is Pride, directed by Matthew Warchus, which is one of those feel-good British films about a bunch of an unlikely group of British people who get pushed out of their comfort zone with, you know, life-affirming and slightly wacky results. And in this case, it's based on the true story about how a group of LGBT activists raise money to help families of the 1984 miners' strike. And the National Union was like reluctant to accept their money, didn't really want to be associated with an LGBT group. And so instead, they took it directly to a small village in Wales and ended up, forming this alliance with a group of people who really had little in common with them. You know, this is one of those movies that it sounds like you know exactly where this might go, but it had like a big following. A lot of people really liked it. It was one that I think won over people who otherwise might resist the something so kind of feel good and so it kind of in the realm of this familiar drama. It's also got a great cast: Bill Nye, Imelda Staunton, Dominic West, Patty Considine, among others. I haven't seen it, and I am looking forward to it. It was one that I was sorry not to catch last year because I know it has a lot of fans.
Made in Japan.
All right, our subject for this episode's Q-Shots, technophobia. I know there's nothing I find more frightening. I'm an old guy, but there's nothing I find more frightening than the 12 o'clock flashing on the VCR. So I'm assuming that's what we're going to be talking about. Movies about the flashing 12 o'clock on the VCR.
On your VCR, which
you
know
you're going to have to reprogram it, and you don't know how to do it.
And you don't want to miss your programs.
That's right, my stories. I don't want to miss my stories, Allison.
Yeah, it's interesting when we picked this as a topic, mm-hmm. and I started looking around at possible films, you realize that any film that highlights technology, it's very rarely good, right? Technology rarely works out well.
Right. Not too many unvarnished, wholly positive portrayals of technology out there. Even the ones that have mostly positive, they always have there's always a tinge of anxiety about them.
Right. And usually, especially in sci-fi films that are shaped around some kind of new development that has changed society.
Right.
Even if it seemingly improves society, like Demolition Man, say, there's a lot of suspicion towards all of those things.
Yes.
Even though, like, disease has been eliminated.
Right. The world has been made almost like a utopia.
Yes.
And yet this is the worst thing that has ever happened.
Yes.
That's actually the thesis of the movie.
Exactly.
That utopia is horrible.
It is.
Right.
And, why would you give up all of these great kind of Luddite things, even if they were...
Right.
They had terrible consequences at the time.
Right. I mean, to me, a world where we eat nothing but Taco Bell sounds pretty good. But apparently, according to Demolition Man, that's bad.
Well, I just remember at the end when he swoops Sandra Bullock up and like kisses her.
Right, because all physical
contact
has been eliminated.
And then you're kind of like, and she's like, ooh. And then you're like, wait. But there was a reason that all physical contact was eliminated.
Right.
They go through that terrible diseases ravage the population.
Correct.
But oh, well.
Right. Sylvester Stallone says it's okay.
Yes.
So I guess it's fine. All right.
Also, movies like Minority Report, movies,
yes.
Almost anything in which this new technology is invented, iRobot, that is supposed to improve society. It never improves society.
Right. Well, let's be fair and say that if it was about a technology that fixed everything and it was true and there was no downside and there was nothing to be worried about, there wouldn't be a lot of drama. You know what I mean?
Right.
If the movie was we invented robots and that everything went really well, that's nice, but that's not that's not a movie. So you need some kind of conflict. So I get it. The conflict is often... And then things went bad. You know, I understand that. But yes, it is interesting how, to me, the fascinating part is that the movies themselves, so many movies, and not just movies where it's explicit that this is a movie about technology, as the movies we will be talking about are, but just how many movies are obsessed with technology and with the technology of movie making and doing cutting edge things and new special effects invariably, though, the movies are always about how that's dangerous and evil. And one of my movies is almost explicitly that tension is one of the most interesting things about it. It's these movies couldn't be made without technology, and their message is often technology is evil and don't trust it.
Right. And that's something, it's a reason that I can find it so I often find it such a kind of glib message to have, because realistically there's always new technology and
right.
it's always a little scary because it's something different from what you grew up with. Right.
Right.
But that we're constantly, our lives are constantly folding in these new technologies.
That's right.
And they just they can maybe slowly affect society, but they're gradual changes. Right.
Yes.
There's no monumental one shift that right. happens and suddenly everything is different in the next month, right? That to have this kind of, I don't know, a lot of this fear seems very, it doesn't seem deeply thought out, I think. And it's one of the things that I'm interested to talk about when we get to Black Mirror, because I think the idea about integrating these things into society is part of it. But yeah, I don't know. A lot of times... when you finally get around to the message of we shouldn't have done that, kind of I don't know if that things really work that way.
I would agree with you completely, except I've been reading Twitter on my phone for the last 5 minutes and haven't been paying attention. But I agree. Yes, whatever you said, indeed, technology is wonderful and there's no downsides whatsoever. Hold on, I have to just Facebook something real quick. Okay, should we get to our picks, Allison?
Yeah.
Do you want me to go first?
Why don't you go first?
Okay, well, it's funny. I didn't immediately plan for this to happen, but as I was kind of picking what I wanted to talk about and watch, I was like, oh, you know what I'm gonna do? I'm gonna do kind of a double feature, and I'm gonna do it about James Cameron. And I think that's a kind of a little bit of an obvious choice because he is kind of the master, the modern master of technophobia.
King Technophobia, yes.
Every movie he makes, really, maybe you could argue True Lies is not all that much about technophobia, although it is about the fear of sort of like dirty bombs or whatever that you know, terrorists might get their hands on this nuclear technology and do something horrible with it. So in that sense, it is. But The Terminator and even Titanic, you know, they're all about the fear of future technology, cutting edge technology coming back to destroy us. So we're going to talk more about him specifically on my second pick. But the first pick, the movie that I really wanted to go back and rewatch because I hadn't seen it in so long, is my first pick. It's actually a movie he co-wrote. He didn't actually direct it. It's called Strange Days from 1995, and it was directed by Kathryn Bigelow. You can actually watch this one right now on Netflix or on Amazon Prime. And the technology that's on display in Strange Days is actually very similar to one in one of the episodes of Black Mirror, The Entire History of You. In that episode, people get these implants where they can replay their memories like with 100% accuracy. Anything they see and experience, they can then go back and rewatch and almost use as like evidence or something like that. And in Strange Days, which is set in 1999, right before the turn of the millennium, but was made in 1995, people wear these elaborate rigs called squids, which allow them to record their experiences and then play them back later off mini discs. That is the cutting edge tech. Mini discs, Allison, that's the future. The future is then. The technology, all right. The technology probably has some practical applications, but humanity, of course, is much more interested in pornography than practicality, and that's mostly what it's used for in the movie. Ralph Fiennes stars as Lenny Nero. He's a black market dealer of these mini discs, which are basically, you know, hardcore porn, illegal activities. The movie opens with this great sequence. It's a first-person POV shot, a long shot of a bank robbery and escape, and then the dark side of this technology really comes on full display when this mysterious serial killer begins murdering people around Los Angeles and delivering the mini discs, the tapes of these crimes, to Lenny, who has to then, you know, solve the mystery before he becomes the target of this killer and also these dirty police officers who are searching for another all-important mini disc that contains evidence of their commission of a heinous crime.
So, do I get the deck from you?
I'll set you up. I'll get you a deck at my car, since my thing is the software.
Clips, right?
Clips, right. Now, listen, I want you to know what we're talking about here, okay? This is not like TV, only better. This is life. It's a piece of somebody's life. It's pure and uncut. It's straight from the cerebral cortex. I mean, you're there. You're doing it. You're seeing it, you're hearing it, you're feeling it.
It's funny. I remember seeing Strange Days. It was either on VHS, I either rented it, or I saw it on HBO or, you know, one of those cable channels back in like 1996, and didn't really like it. I think the fact that it was co-written by James Cameron, and at the time I definitely expected something more like Terminator 2, like just a giant action movie. And that's not what Strange Days is. And certainly the technology side of things haven't dated all that well. The idea of physical media being this all-important thing. The Strange Days of 2015 would look a little different, but I have to say, revisiting it for the first time in almost 20 years, I was kind of blown away by how good this movie is and how much better it is than I remembered. Angela Bassett plays Ralph Fiennes' character's friend and bodyguard, and she kicks so much ass in this movie. It's really awesome to watch. It's fun because also it's, you know, even though it's not a hugely action-packed movie, it's a thriller where the hero is kind of the damsel in distress.
Yeah, and she is the tough
guy. And she's the protector. She's the tough guy. She's the one who's always beating people up and pulling guns and saving the day, and he's the one who kind of needs protecting. He's the one that gets that more typically feminine role. So I thought that was, first of all, fantastic. I love that aspect, that kind of inversion. The action that is in the movie, there's not a ton, but what's there is great. You know, Kathryn Bigelow is a fabulous director, and the first-person stuff is really cool and actually pretty well done and pretty convincing. And the movie really does explore the fascinating, potentially interesting, but also very disturbing implications of this virtual reality technology, the way it could be used to maybe solve crimes, but also the way it could be used almost to make very horrifying snuff films. And the fact that it is first person, that we kind of take the perspective of the killer. You know, that's very kind of implicating us in the crimes, I think, makes it a very interesting look at voyeurism and at all the sorts of things that we go to the movies for. The other thing I have to say I was very surprised by was just how timely this movie is now in 2015. Even though it's set in 1999, it's made in 1995. It's about mini disc technology and specifically the stuff about law enforcement. I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say that the evidence these dirty cops want to get back involves their involvement in the death of a major black celebrity. And the film in general is almost as terrified of the cops as it is of this squid technology. And I mean, that makes sense. It was written right after the Rodney King riots, right. But sadly, it really feels very relevant to what's going on right now all over the country. And there's a lot to chew over in the cop characters here, what they do, how the public reacts to them, the end of the movie, what the end of the movie says, how reality has been similar to but also very different from the end of this movie, which is a little more cut and dry in terms of what happens when you find evidence of a crime.
Yeah.
But still, I have to say that all that stuff, the fact that it's there, that it's still relevant, really threw me for a loop, kind of made it for me like a real must-see if you've never seen it. I really totally 180'd on this movie, was not a fan of it when I saw it as a teenager. I was, you know, probably just went over my head. And I, like I said, I wasn't really, I wanted it to be something it wasn't, but what it is really, really good. So that's Strange Days. Check it out if you've never seen it. Available on Netflix or Amazon Prime.
Yeah, I have to take another look at that movie. I liked it when it came out, but I haven't seen it since then.
There are some things that don't hold up well. Obviously the fact that everyone's carrying around shoe boxes of mini discs looks a little silly, but it's surprising how the rest of it isn't silly, I would say, and how a lot of it kind of feels prescient, maybe more than it did in 1995, which is kind of interesting. So, yeah, it's definitely worth revisiting if you haven't seen it in a while.
All right. For my first pick, I also picked a film that involves some immediately outdated technology, and it's one that I think holds up. I mean, maybe even in spite of, or maybe because of this. It is The Ring, which is available for rent on iTunes.
It's about the fear of the blinking 12 o'clock
exactly,
on the VCR.
That terrifying 12 o'clock just destroys people's lives. You know, Japanese horror deals with a lot of technology, or especially in its kind of heyday, dealt with a lot of ideas of technology that can become infected, that the supernatural can kind of find this way in through technology that's omnipresent in our lives. You know, in addition to The Ring, which is obviously about a haunted videotape, you have Pulse, which, you know, dealt with ghosts that invade via the internet, though that also, I think, spoke to a very specific kind of Japanese sense of depression and isolation that happened to kind of combine nicely with the idea of the internet and computers being everywhere. Pulse got a terrible US remake, and Takashi Miike's One Miss Call was almost a parody of these sorts of films, as well as an earnest version itself. It was about haunted cell phones, basically.
You're running out of data!
Exactly. But The Ring is still my favorite. And One Miss Call, incidentally, also got a terrible American remake. The Ring is still my favorite. And though the Japanese version is great in the original, and I think has a scarier take on the most famous kind of climactic scene, I'm going to talk about the American version, which I actually prefer, the 2002 version directed by Gore Verbinski, that is maybe a little more explicit about the idea of technology and of technology as this link between the present day and between this moment of trauma that happened that becomes like the vector for the ghost.
Have you heard about this videotape that kills you when you watch it?
What kind of tape?
A tape. A regular tape. People run it, I don't know. You start to play it, and it's like somebody's nightmare. Then suddenly, this woman comes on, smiling at you, right? Seeing you through the screen. And as soon as it's over, your phone rings. Someone knows you've watched it. And what they say is, you will die in 7 days.
And certainly it's the videotape is outdated, but also you have at another point, you know, the ghost makes a call, right? Like in The Ring, you watch a videotape, you get a call after you've watched this kind of weird video. in which a child says 7 days and 7 days later you die. And even at one point in the movie, Naomi Watts's character, the main character, someone watches the tape and then she doesn't take the call. It goes, she lets it go directly to her answering machine. So there's plenty of outdated technology.
Yeah.
I think it works fine. I mean, because the movie has a few great ideas beyond the inherent creepiness of its ghost girl and the vengeance that she exacts. You know, I think it has this idea that you're on the hook, like the rules of it, which are that, you know, once you're in, you're on the hook unless you can pass it off to someone else, which is an idea that the upcoming horror film It Follows also deals with very well and kind of makes you... it means that you also have an option that basically involves passing on this burden onto someone else. I think it also includes the very interesting idea that just because you follow the rules of the usual horror movie and create closure doesn't mean that the spirit wants closure or the spirit will be placated by it, which is, I think, plays into the latter part of this movie and I think is really, really well done. But in particular, this movie is all about the idea that technology has allowed not just this monstrous presence into the lives of all of these people, but also this terrible incident, right? This bad thing that happens. You have, this movie has a totally traditionally atmospheric creepy house in a creepy island, like remote creepy island that the characters travel out to. And yet most of the action takes place in totally non-creepy, slick, contemporary Seattle, you know, which is where Naomi Watts's character lives with her son. And technology in this case is used to create like a direct portal, like a literal portal, right? But that there's a direct passage between that terrible atmospheric place and your living room that the ghost is able to have access, that there's no, it's not a question of the traditional haunted house where you go to it, you're unwise enough to go to it. The haunted house comes to you, right? The ghost comes to you. And I think that idea that is enabled because of technology, because of these videotapes, because of this idea that is viral, is one that I think is very creepy. And beyond just the moment in which Watts kind of looks out at the wall of condos opposite her and everyone's got a TV and is kind of bathing in the blue light of the TV, you know, it's this idea that events are much more connected to us. And I think that goes beyond any supernatural sense, that the world is a much smaller place and that like dark history doesn't stay that way. It's very close. It's become very close to us courtesy of technology. And I think that that's something that has aged really well with this film, even if videotapes seem kind of laughable now.
It's like viral. It's like things going viral.
Exactly.
Before things went viral.
Before things went viral. And the kind of the urban legend aspect of it, you would think would only be like kind of amplified in that way, you know, when things are more easily passed around. So that's The Ring, and it's available for rent on all the usual platforms.
All right, that's a good pick. I kind of like the American version better too, right?
Yeah.
I don't think I ever saw the sequel, the American sequel.
I did not see it, and it sounded horrible.
It's supposedly not very good.
Yeah.
But the
American version
is
one of my favorite horror movies. It's very scary.
Yeah, after you picked it, I was looking at some clips, and I was like, I need to rewatch The Ring. I haven't seen it probably since it came out, and I remember being really scared by that the first time, again, because of my VCR fears. But even without the VCR element, I imagine
it would hold up well. Make your television a little frightening.
Mm.
Actually, yes. And later, I happened to incidentally pick two movies in which flickering television screens are harbingers of doom.
Interesting. A little glimpse into your psyche and your personal fears, I think. All right. Well, we'll get to that other pick in a minute. First, let me do my other pick, which, as promised, is another James Cameron movie. It is, to date, the most recent James Cameron movie. And that is Avatar, which is available for rent right now on iTunes. I think you can get it, you can purchase it elsewhere online, but I was looking and I only could find it to rent on iTunes. And the reason I just rewatched this last month was it was the fifth anniversary of the release of Avatar. It came out just before Christmas in 2009. And there were a bunch of pieces last month online about it and about the anniversary, including one by Scott Mendelson at Forbes.com that were about the anniversary, about how Avatar, you know, it was the biggest movie of all time, and it still is, by an incredible margin. It made $2.7 billion worldwide, and the number two movie, which is also by James Cameron, Titanic, is at about $2.1 billion. So it's $600 million higher than the closest competitor for the title of the biggest movie ever. But 5 years later, culturally speaking, you know, it seems to have kind of vanished. No one talks about it. We don't quote it. You know, we don't rewatch it all that much. We don't remember it all that well. So what happened? So after reading Scott Mendelson's piece, I was interested in, you know, seeing it for myself. So I rewatched it. I wrote a piece about it on Screen Crush, which you can find online right now. The piece is called Back to Pandora: Why Has Avatar Been Forgotten Just 5 Years After Its Release? And I will be honest and say that before I watched the movie, I expected the answer to that question to be, well, because it's not a very good movie, that it was just a showcase for 3D. People got really into the technology side of it, that it was a spectacle. It became a kind of word of mouth thing. Everyone wanted to see it in the theater, see it in IMAX, see it in 3D. And that's it. That's all it was. And once that aspect went away, there was no reason to watch it. But that was not what I discovered. And I found that even on the small screen, you know, you lose the 3D. At least I do. I don't have a 3D Blu-ray player. But even on the small screen, it is still a really good-looking movie, particularly the stuff at night when this alien world of Pandora, where the film is set, becomes this day-glow, bioluminescent wonderland. And for all that it's, you know, been accused of being a very simple movie, simple story, good versus evil, it's dances with wolves in space, there's a lot of stuff going on beneath the surface, I felt like.
The concept is to drive these remotely controlled bodies called avatars. They're grown from human DNA mixed with DNA of the natives.
Marine in an avatar body. That's a potent mix.
You get me what I need, I'll see to it you get your legs, babe. Your real legs.
Hell yeah, sir.
Looks like you. This is your avatar.
Just relax and let your mind go blank. It shouldn't be hard for you.
We mentioned in the introduction that the whole, that complex relationship with technology, which in Avatar is one of the most complicated ever, because this is a movie about this fear of technology and the beauty of the natural world and how the natural world needs to be protected and defended and is special, and how it's so much superior to the technological world. And yet, this natural world that we're looking at in the movie is totally unnatural and was created by computers and motion capture technology and couldn't exist without that technology. So it has a very complicated relationship there. And then there's the whole use of technology in the movie, which is in these avatars where the human beings create these avatar bodies, these alien bodies that they can go into. And when they do that, it's sort of a giant metaphor for going to the movies, right? Because the humans, they go into a dark little room, and all of a sudden, when they go inside it, they become another person. They get to, like, sort of experience life through someone else's lives. So it's sort of the experience of movie going as an idea, as a platform to make this whole story, which I guess I knew when I saw it the first time, but I found a lot more interesting this time. The whole sort of metaphor for movie going, something that I didn't really pick up on originally. So there's a lot to chew on there. Is Sam Worthington a great actor? No, he's not a great actor. Is the dialogue hokey at times? Yeah, it's pretty hokey. Is the movie basically Aliens, another James Cameron movie with the heroes and villains flopped? Yeah, a little bit, although I think that's kind of interesting, the fact that he remade Aliens, except this time it's like the queen is like the is the good guy this time, and the Marines are the bad guys. I think that's kind of interesting as well. But whatever. I mean, I really think Avatar, and I didn't expect to say this a few weeks ago, that it's a pretty good movie, and that's kind of what I took away, is that also that it is a movie and not a brand. You know what I mean? That although it perhaps will become one soon when it becomes three sequels and a Disney theme park, that there's something to be said for the fact that this is like the biggest movie of all time, and they spent however many hundreds of millions of dollars on it, and it wasn't based on anything. It was an original idea. It wasn't made to invigorate an old intellectual property or a TV show or anything like that. It was just a made to be a movie. And I think there's something to be said for that. And I think that James Cameron's relationship with technology remains one of the most interesting in all of cinema. So that's Avatar, and you can rent that right now on iTunes.
So for my other pick, I wanted to pick, it's interesting to go from the largest movie of all time to a movie that was like a $50,000 13-day shoot movie. But I wanted to pick a movie that was small and dealt with themes of technophobia, which is actually something that I think crops up in a lot of indie films as well. You don't need to just be a giant, like a big budget sci-fi tentpole to display a lot of suspicion about technophobia. Mm-hmm. And the movie I picked is The Signal, which is currently streaming on Amazon Prime, not to be confused with the very pretty, very frustrating sci-fi movie that was released this year of the same name.
Just came out, right?
Yeah.
This is not that one.
This is not
the
that
previous
one.
The Signal.
Signal was from 2007, and like the other Signal, it's a Sundance movie, and is a very, it's an unusual anthology film in that it is set in one world with one group of characters, but there are three directors, David Bruckner, Dan Bush, and Jacob Gentry, who each took a chapter. So it all fits together to create one larger story about these characters and this thing that happens. But each chapter has a different tone and follows a different part of the story. So it's set in a city called Terminus, in which there's a broadcast starts showing on all televisions and phones and other electronic devices that broadcast signals that induces psychosis in people. In the case of TVs, it looks like this kind of warped, trippy looking, but like not quite comprehensible looking feed. And the longer people look at it, the more it tends to kind of bring out latent violence, to make them kind of just unstable, to make them highly susceptible to suggestion, and to basically lead to chaos. And each of the three main characters kind of gets a chapter. The central characters are Maya, played by Inessa Ramsey, Ben, played by Justin Welborn, who's the man she's been having an affair with, and Lewis, played by AJ Bowen, who's been in things like You're Next, and who gives really great cheery psychopath in this and in other things, as Maya's husband.
That was strange. The TV turned itself on.
What's going on? Why isn't anything working? Everybody's out in the hallway.
That's the same sound that was coming through the phone. What's the matter with you?
One thing that I really admire about this movie, as much as it's almost by definition like any anthology movie, very uneven, is that it creates a sense of scale while being like working with super limited budgets. You know, you have a sense of a city that is off kind of in the sidelines, slowly falling apart thanks to the signal. But it focuses on what's basically a love triangle and about two people who have been never quite managing to run away with one another, and about the husband who's been kind of jealous and possessive and doesn't want to let his wife go. I would say the first chapter is the best, which is the one about when the signal starts, and also focuses mostly on Maya. It's very creepy, and not just in the dread you feel for when the signal is everywhere on all of the screens, on the phones, when anyone tries them, but also this idea that the movie kind of brings up again and again, which is Maya playing this mix CD that Ben has made for her. So she puts it on and kind of blocks out everything. And you have great shots of her walking through just carnage and chaos in her apartment building or on the streets while the music fills the soundtrack and kind of blocks everything out. And the movie does kind of embrace that idea that, you know, that's also technology, right? But it's kind of, it's sheltering her. But that, I mean, the one thing that I will say, and the second chapter goes into like kind of black comedy, and the third chapter is kind of like the most action and gore and suspense. But the more that the movie gets into exploring what, like pinning down what the signal might be, or also what it might stand for metaphor wise, there's one part where Lewis says, why would, like, while yelling at his wife about the demise of their relationship, you know, why won't you just shut up and watch TV? And it's a little too on the nose, I think. And it's a little weaker when those parts happen. But it manages a kind of great end of the world style poetry in these images of people just gazing dazedly at these TVs and emerging from them, having absorbed some sort of message and coming, emerging from them being warped. And I think that without having to maybe make that so easy as being, oh, it's a metaphor for television, it's a metaphor for all of us staring at screens and getting separated, it manages to be a very evocative, recurring image that, you know, I think kind of surprised me. It's a very small film, and there are times where it feels kind of ragged, but I think it has a lot of ambition, and that shows in impressive ways. So it's definitely worth checking out. It's on Amazon Prime, The Signal.
Well, I think it's an interesting choice, going grainless.
It's a brave choice.
I'm sorry, but I couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I was going to play some redos from the Fraser Road days.
Yay!
Stuff from the last night. Depressing or fun?
You know, half the organic memories you have are junk. Just not trustworthy.
Colleen works in brain development.
With half the population, you can implant false memories. Just by asking leading questions in therapy, you can make people remember getting lost in shopping malls they never visited, getting bothered by paedophile babysitters they never had. I'm just happier now.
Time now for this episode's Listener's Choice Review. On each episode of FilmSpotting SVU, we give you three films or TV shows to choose from, and your votes, either through email or at our website, FilmSpottingSVU.com, determine the main review of the week. Last time, your options were the Dutch thriller Borgman, Sam Mendes' Oscar winner American Beauty, and the British sci-fi series Black Mirror, and it seems like we've got a lot of Anglophiles in the SVU audience, Allison, as Black Mirror was the runaway winner, topping American Beauty and Borgman, 57%. To 27% and 14% respectively. So it's Black Mirror, created by writer Charlie Brooker and originally aired on Channel 4 in the UK back in 2011. So far, the series has run for two seasons of three episodes each, along with a recent Christmas special starring Mad Men's Jon Hamm that just aired in England and I guess on DirecTV in America.
Yeah, I think the day after Christmas or maybe on Christmas.
But it's yet to make its way online in America, at least in any legal form. The series has drawn comparisons to The Twilight Zone, and it is very easy to see why. Black Mirror is an anthology show with a strong science fiction and horror bent. Each episode ruminates on the future of technology, from social media to artificial intelligence, and many episodes end with a sort of shocking twist that became a hallmark of Rod Serling's work as well. Now, Allison, you have already published what you called, quote, the definitive ranking of Black Mirror over at BuzzFeed.
Mm-hmm.
And we can talk about your feelings about individual episodes and which are the best and worst in a bit. But first, I wanted to get your opinion on this Twilight Zone comparison. In my opinion, the Twilight Zone is one of the best television shows in history. So, you know, a lot of the episodes still to this day, I think, hold up as just incredible works of, you know, speculative science fiction. So at least in my mind, a comparison to The Twilight Zone is a very big deal. So the question to you, Allison, is does Black Mirror earn the comparison? I mean, sure, it's like The Twilight Zone in format, but is it also like it in terms of quality?
I think that The Twilight Zone comparison does it a little bit of a disservice.
Okay.
And I say this as someone who is a big Twilight Zone fan as well.
Okay.
I think we've even done an IFC News podcast about it a while
did,
ago.
Back in the day, yeah.
Back in the day. But I think that, I mean, you mentioned that each episode ends with a shocking twist, but I actually would disagree. I think that one of the things that is very different from The Twilight Zone is that I think a lot of these, they don't end with a punchline in quite the same way. I think that, you know, I think a lot of The Twilight Zone episodes present a scenario and then they kind of have a moral, mm-hmm. right? They're like the ironic kind of the guy who all he wants to do is have more time to read. And then he ends up in a post-apocalyptic world in which that's all he has and then breaks his glasses.
Right.
And I don't think that these episodes are kind of prone to that as much. They each have I mean, they each have escalating action, certainly. But I do think that it makes a little bit more of an effort to look at a world in which, to present like worlds in which a particular type of technology exists, even in a more intimate sense.
Okay, but I mean, an episode like, I'm just looking at a list of episodes here. Episode like 15 Million Merits, I would say, has sort of a twist ending in terms of the very last shot is sort of, I would say, a twist and perhaps makes you rethink the episode that's come before. White Bear
proceeds. White Bear definitely has a twist.
Most of the episode seems to be one thing, and then there's a twist at the end of it. So,
sure, but what about the entire history of you? What is the twist?
Maybe that one doesn't have a twist.
What about the one after that? The one about...
I would say the end of Be Right Back has a little bit of the end.
I don't think that has a twist at all.
I would say it has a sort of... It seems a lot of the episodes seems to have like sort of a final scene and then an epilogue scene where it reconfigures some of the things you were thinking. And I think that in that way that it is a little Twilight Zone-y.
I don't know. I disagree. I still disagree.
Even the Waldo moment, which is one of the least science fiction-y ones, has a sort of like during the closing credits, there's like a, I don't know if it's a twist, but there's sort of a like very.
Well, it applies the idea it's been dealing with, right? It applies it directly. Like it skips into the future.
Right. But in a way that to me also felt like, the, you know, those Twilight Zone episodes, like you said, there was a lot of be careful what you wish for kind of things. And that one has a very be careful what you wish for kind of bent to that last part. So,
sure.
I did feel that a lot of them did feel pretty Twilight Zone-y to me in a good way. To me, it was in a good way.
The reason I resist that is because I feel like so many of the Twilight Zones have this kind of like this almost moral angle.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like when the one thing that makes this show, and this is certainly there are some episodes that have more of a moral angle than others, but I think that something that makes this show work well is that it deals more with like this technology that is kind of enfolded in people's lives and how people live in it.
Right.
You know, as opposed to, I think, I don't know, like each, so many Twilight Zone scenarios seem built around, they're like fables.
Yeah. That's interesting though. Like, I think we both really like this show, but we see it kind of differently. Like I did feel like there was a lot of kind of moralizing in a lot of these episodes. I mean, there's a lot of didactic speeches in a lot of these shows.
But they're also undercut. Like, I feel like the show undercuts its didacticism all the time.
Do you want to give me an example of it undercutting its didacticism?
Well, I mean, I feel like, and the entire history of you is it's not a cautionary tale about recording everything. It's about how someone's existing personality flaw is just magnified by the fact that this technology is available, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, but it could also be read as a pretty cautionary tale about
I don't think that it's positive about this technology, but I don't think that it's saying the reason that he is jealous in this way is because he has access to this technology. Anyway, let's talk about specific examples.
Okay.
But I mean, like, I feel pretty strongly about this, that is one of the reasons I like this show a lot.
That's fine. I feel pretty strongly like that that episode that you keep mentioning that one too, The Entire History of You, which is a fabulous episode. Probably is the best episode of the six. I haven't seen the Christmas special yet. You have. To me, what was so interesting about it is it proceeds from this idea of like, oh, yes, wouldn't it be interesting to have this ability? This is the one where people have this implant where they can watch their entire lives, essentially, you know, back. And
like Google Glass. It's like a more invasive Google
Glass. Imagine if Google Glass was always on and you could just in a second, you could replay something. So like if I had sent something earlier in the podcast and Allison disagrees with that, that's what I said. She could just immediately call it up and say, see, there you go. You did say it. Or maybe I didn't. And I could say, no, I didn't say it. So ha, I was right all along. And the it sort of begins in a way that makes it seem really kind of interesting. And then we see it sort of destroy this relationship, which I thought was fascinating, but also is, I certainly didn't feel like the show was not taking a stand that this was a it seemed pretty against this, the idea of this technology to me. I don't know. I didn't feel come away with it going.
I mean, I feel like that's the least interesting question that you can apply to that, because it's saying like, this is a world in which this fairly plausible, like obviously more extreme version than anything we're approaching now.
Right.
But like not implausible, right? Like,
no, not at all implausible.
By any means,
no.
Like exists. And then what is life like with that?
Right.
I don't know. I feel like saying that it's a cautionary tale. I don't, it seems like the, like a kind of needless question.
You didn't feel like most of this show is about cautionary tales about the dangers of technology,
no.
A technological future.
No. I mean, I think that it's about, I think it's running with, I think that's too simple.
Okay. I mean, but that's sort of, I mean, maybe it is a very, very well thought out, very complex version of that, but that's sort of what the show is. I mean, it's taking all these different.
It's taking different types of like ideas of technology that are like not that far removed from where we are. Right. And kind of
right.
like pushing them out to the further to the future. Right.
Right.
Like two extremes.
Yeah.
Yes. But I mean,
and often finding that the futures that come out are horrible and they're full of these horrible things.
But not because of the technology, because of like human personality traits, right?
I mean, that's fair. That's very fair to say.
White Bear is based entirely. I mean, there's not like technology is not the flaw there. People are the flaw.
That's true. Although it also has this wonderful visual. This is this one that we alluded to earlier in the show, I think, where it's about this woman who wakes up with no memory of how she got there. And it seems
it's basically like The Signal, the movie I talked about.
Right.
Before.
It is like The Signal, like almost like technology has turned people into zombies and people are running around with their cell phone cameras filming her instead of helping her. And no one will talk to her. And they're all just like these cell phone zombies. And you're right. Ultimately, it's not that technology is to blame for what's going on. But you do have that kind of feeling of we're living in a world where we've become so fixated on what's going on the little screen in front of us that we're not willing to help someone. And I think that's got to be part of why
visual. But the point of that episode is that everyone was fixated on blaming her for being so monstrous with that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, mild spoilers here, but that there is like a... There's a murder. It's based on the idea that there was this real murder that happened and someone video recorded it rather than intervene.
Mm-hmm.
But like the real, like then it becomes like this extra level of monstrousness of people's self-righteous anger about that, right?
Right. I get what you're saying, that ultimately the monster is us or humanity, right?
Is as monstrous. Right.
Okay. But sure. I mean, we're kind of arguing about
semantics.
Yeah,
but I guess what I'm saying is that the cell phone and the idea of like observing that. I mean, like people watched murders before those existed. The technology just makes it easier for them to kind of latch on to hating her.
Okay. Okay. I mean, I would just say that, yes, I think you make a fine point that humanity comes off looking pretty terrible in all these episodes as well. But just that, you know, that these spectacular advances in technology don't come off looking all that great.
I guess for me, and we can move on from this. I guess what I'm saying is I feel like the point of the show is that technology often just magnifies some of the worst aspects of human behavior.
All right, that's
but that
fair.
Technology itself is not, it's the mirror.
Right. That's the black mirror.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. We're arguing over, it's funny because we're like kind of arguing, but I think it's a show we both really like.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed watching it. I mean, we watched.
So which were your favorites?
I really did like The Entire History of You. And I really liked Be Right Back as well.
Those
which
are
is,
my two favorites.
Right.
As
which
well.
Is one yeah. about, that's about this.
It's kind of her. It has a touch of
very
her
much.
It.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's very much like her. I mean, in general, and I actually really liked White Bear also, even though that is kind of the most Twilight Zone-y episode. I really enjoyed that one as well. I thought that was really, really disturbing. And again, that image of these cell phone zombies running around, just chasing her everywhere, but not helping her as these ridiculous looking
horror
hunters
movie kind
yeah,
of people come,
are
yeah.
trying to kill her. I just thought that was just absolutely fabulous. And then the twist I thought was really fun, too. I thought that one was really great. I will say, in general, I thought that the show is better the more it speculates about the future.
So did you?
I thought it's the weaker as it sort of critiques the current state of things. Like
right.
the two episodes that are sort of set more in a identifiable present,
which would be
the national anthem and the Waldo moment.
Yeah.
I thought were both the two weakest episodes.
Yeah,
and I thought the more futuristic episodes were the better episodes.
So did you think 15 Million Merits is the most futuristic episode? Right,
and I thought that one was really good too.
Yeah.
Let's
talk about the national anthem briefly, since it's the one. The show starts off with this episode. But it's the episode that has no sci-fi to it at all.
Yeah, it's like the least like every other episode.
Everything in it could plausibly happen. I mean, there's no technology in it that does not already exist, right?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I was a little, I was wondering how easy it would be to kidnap who, you know, this person who's basically like Princess Diana or someone like this. I was sort of skeptical about how plausible that component is because it all hinges on this kidnapping. But other than that, yes, there's no sci-fi element to it. It's all about Twitter and social media and all that sort of stuff. And it's very crude and, which I'm not necessarily opposed to. I love crudeness. But I don't know. It just didn't seem as insightful about either technology or human nature as the other episodes, which were more speculative and forward thinking.
Yeah, this was not one that I liked as much the first time I saw this, which was last year, the first time I watched the series. But rewatching this in the time of the interview, it was interesting to me in
the interview, the film, the interview,
the film, the interview, and the kind of like the cyber attack and kind of like. Terrorist
the pressure
threat.
To
the
do
terrorist
something.
Threat, yeah, right. To be like to have kind of an individual terrorist group say, remember the 11th of September, and
right,
you know, and also to say that in exchange for something that is not kind of like, you know, to be like pull this thing, you can pull a movie, right? It's not a life and death thing. It is not, and I think in this case, the stakes are like humiliating, right? Like the thing that the terrorist wants is something that's humiliating, but also not life and death.
Right.
And that like kind of, it raises that question of being like, at what point do you say, do you fold? Right.
That, right.
Like at what point do you give in? And I thought that we're like, given what happened with the interview, it gained a little bit of extra kind of, I don't know, like pointiness, I think.
Prescience.
Yeah. I mean like
relevance
that, I mean, I do think it's the most kind of, there's the least emotion to it. It has like, it's the most cold, I think, out of all of these. But I do, it does, its logic, I think, is very sound. Like there are very few parts in it where you're like, that would not have happened.
Right.
You know?
No, that's, I mean, that's true. Your comment about the interview is interesting. I didn't think of it as I was watching it, but I absolutely can see what you're saying as you're describing it. I would say, I mean, again, it's not, I don't know, maybe it's not a twist, but sort of the revelation of, who is making the threat here? Who's done the kidnapping and why? And
yeah.
That rang to me a little bit false, and sort of the aftermath of the event also to me rang a little bit false as well. Certain parts of it, we don't want to spoil it, but it just, to me, it was like, it was sort of an interesting what if, I suppose, but not one that I thought was handled with particular, like, the developments in some of the other episodes are kind of, they really do take you by surprise, but they are also logical. I mean, what you're saying, how everything that happens is understandable in that episode. Yeah, I guess that's true, but
I think
maybe almost too unexpected, you know, like it almost proceeds too logically where you see everything happening and it's nothing all that surprising.
I mean, I think like the point, the part of it that I think just really rang true for me is the fact that everyone would, of course, watch. Like, that there's this thing that happens that's bad, and they're like, please, no one watch. Everyone look away. Which is something that has come up in horror movies as well, right? Where they're like, stay off of this website. This person will die if the traffic's too high.
Right.
Like but, like, you're like, of course, everyone would watch.
But and that's sort of a theme of the whole series, right? There's a lot of recurring themes of
people watching.
And watching in mass and the destructiveness of that.
And also the ability of kind of co-opting, right? The ability of the market to co-opt anything, any form of rebellion can be co-opted.
Yes.
And there's certainly, Charlie Brooker has some deep cynicism
about
that.
Right. And that's sort of the other kind of contemporary one is very much like that too. The Waldo moment, which is about basically like, I saw it as like, what if the South Park guys like decided to run Cartman as a actual candidate, you know, and like get him on a ballot somewhere. And I had a hard time seeing that scenario kind of going the way.
Beyond novelty.
Yeah. The fact that, you know, let's actually do it. Like they create the scenario where they put the candidate on the ballot. First of all, I don't know that you could actually do that, but
right.
let's assume, I'm not an expert in British politics. Let's assume you could, that, you know, they do it basically just so they have an excuse to prank this politician. That's very kind of snooty and uptight, but then he catches on. And to me, it felt like they thought they were making kind of like a network or something like that. And doesn't to me have like kind of the snap or the bite or the sharpness of satire that something like that does.
Yeah. And I think that my big complaint with that episode is just that it never makes the case for why Waldo is so compelling. Like, he's not
that charismatic. Like,
literally
his jokes aren't that funny.
The character who is the failed comedian who is behind Waldo says over and over again, like, I don't know anything about politics, like, right. I can't do this. And I actually had like a big back and forth with Emily Nussbaum, the TV critic at The New Yorker, about the Waldo moment, which I did not like, and she was a big proponent of.
Okay.
And she saw it as a kind of like pulling out this dark undercurrent in things that she likes, like the Colbert Report, and being like, there's a tendency, and I think this is what Charlie Brooker was going for a bit, that there are nihilistic undertones. It's much easier to tear down.
Sure,
right?
The Daily Show. People love to watch The Daily Show, but not the real news.
Right. I guess my complaint with that is that Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and John Oliver, the reigning kings of like parody in the US, certainly,
right.
all seem extremely responsible and informed, you know?
Right.
And Waldo is not. Waldo doesn't engage at all. Waldo just makes dick jokes and,
right.
you know.
And
like
not even that good dick jokes.
No, like he
could
he's
do better.
Not funny.
Right.
He has no substance.
Right.
It seems too easy to make his success go well.
Yeah. There's like much sharper satire in any given episode of John Oliver's show than there is in that
yeah.
one.
Yeah. And much sharper satire, I think, in most of the rest of the show,
yes.
which is what makes
Agreed.
The Waldo moments so disappointing. And for me, like the best episodes, the two that you mentioned also as ones that you like, which are The Entire History of You and Be Right Back, they happen to be the most intimate ones, mm-hmm. but I think they also make the best, especially The Entire History of You, I think, like just in brief flashes, makes a very convincing case for a world in which this technology is omnipresent, you know, from the airport security to the fact that it's integrated
right.
into jobs, and then to absolutely how it destroys this relationship. And I think Be Right Back, I mean, you never see much of the wider kind of world beyond this household, but
yeah.
I mean, that's all you really need. It opens up all kinds of interesting ideas about making finding a digital kind of copy of someone, like building up a copy of someone based on their digital footprint that they've left behind in ways that I think are very complicated.
Yeah.
Like
it's smart episode.
Its emotions about the use of that technology are also very ambivalent, I think,
right.
in ways that I really like.
And the most interesting things about it are the ways in which that, right. So that episode, which I don't think we've described, is basically that this couple, the husband of the couple dies, and the wife, who's sort of incredibly distraught over it, is someone else signs her up for the service where it's, you know, he's not really speaking from beyond the grave. They sort of take all of his,
he's like a bot,
his online presence, analyze it, and sort of turn it into an AI that will respond and act the way he would.
Right.
Right. And then the next step beyond that is that he can be turned into basically like a robot that looks exactly like him. And the things that this robot does better than the real guy in terms of like physical intimacy, which I thought was really funny. But then in terms of things that he doesn't do well, because, he never talked about this online. You know, I thought that was really, really interesting. It just showed that they had really thought through this premise from a lot of different angles. You know, it wasn't a one dimensional portrait of a world. Like you said, even though it's really about this one couple, they really thought about what this scenario,
the implications
of
it, right, and that
great.
It also it allows that it is good for her for a while, like
yes. it's not
this terrible
bad.
Evil that
right.
she kind of understands at a certain point that it's not working anymore, but that
right.
like yeah it's very ambivalent in a way that I like.
Yeah, but we've already talked for about 20 minutes, so we should wrap it up. The one thing I wanted to say though that we haven't mentioned at all that I really liked about this was I love the fact that it is an anthology series, which
yeah.
is so rare these days. You know, people are obsessed with serialization, the absolute opposite of the anthology. And in that sense, Black Mirror could not be more old-fashioned. I mean, the whole Twilight Zone thing, that is a 50-year-old series. And this show makes that dated format feel so fresh. And I think the fact that it is talking about cutting-edge technology definitely helps. But it really just shows the strength of anthology shows, regardless of what you're making it about. The fact that, you know, in the case of Be Right Back, we were just talking about, you know, you probably can't get Domhnall Gleeson, a guy who's in, you know, Star Wars and all these movies, probably tough to get him to commit to a 5-year show, much less a one season of a show. but you can get him to do one episode of Black Mirror, and he's great. He's the husband who dies and comes back to life in a sense in this robot, and I thought he was fantastic. And there's great British actors in all the episodes.
Yeah, Toby Kebbell in Entire History of Goo is fantastic.
And you probably couldn't get a lot of these actors if you were doing a full show. So the fact that it really shows that, you know, I don't think we need Black Mirror US, but I think it would be great to see more anthology shows that, you know, like, cause almost like True Detective. It's like, well, we can do one season with Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson and another season with Vince Vaughn or whoever else. It's like, take that idea and make it smaller again. Do the anthology. Bring great actors to television for one episode. Right. That, I think, is a great idea that we need to see more of.
Agreed. I think the trick is really that you get a writer with as sharp a vision and right. voice as Charlie Brooker.
Right.
And his, I think, this feels, I mean, I think the thing that makes this work so well is that you have all of these different series, but there is a sense of a unified vision. And it's a very...
Yeah, it's a very... Well, it's very like... Again, that's like the Twilight Zone. Yeah. It really has a cohesive kind of cynical view of humanity and of technology as well, Allison.
Mm-hmm. Well, here, one last question for you.
Okay.
The Entire History of You has been optioned by Robert Downey Jr.'s production company for a potential movie remake.
Uh-huh.
Do you want this episode or any of them? Do you think any of them would benefit from being longer? And big screen.
No, I actually felt, well, I mean, I'll say this. I did feel, as much as I enjoyed watching the show, not the most visually dynamic show. The show has a nice look. It's very crisp and bright HD. It looks good. It's well shot, but it doesn't exactly... It looks like TV. It doesn't leap off the screen with a lot of visual dynamism. So that's something maybe a movie could bring to some of these episodes. They could make them look a little more exciting. But I actually thought a lot of the episodes were maybe 10 minutes too long. Like, I wouldn't have minded a 30-minute or 35-minute cut of some of these episodes. You know, Twilight Zone was at its best in the half-hour format. There are seasons of the Twilight Zone that are hour-long. Most of those episodes aren't that good. And so the episodes that were longer, sometimes I thought could have been a little shorter. So The Entire History of You is a very rich idea. It could be a good movie, but in a lot of these cases, I actually would not have minded a 30-minute cut as opposed to a longer version.
Yeah, I have seen the Christmas episode, and it's got some great ideas, but it is, I think, 65 minutes long. Maybe it's longer than, not 65 minutes. It's actually longer than the other ones. It's a Christmas special.
Wikipedia says it's 75 minutes.
75 minutes. So it's like a feature length thing.
Right.
And I think it definitely doesn't benefit from that.
Okay.
It feels like it maybe should have been two separate episodes, but there's still a ton of interesting stuff going on in there if you watch it, which we don't condone. Yes.
Until it comes to America
Until
legally.
Until it comes to America legally.
All right. Well, that was our discussion of Black Mirror, and all of the episodes, except the Christmas special, are currently available to stream on Netflix. As we are recording this, it is the first weekend of the new year, so not a lot to talk about in terms of new movies. We're gonna skip that for this episode. Hopefully, we'll have some new movies to talk about next time. So let's go straight to Behind the Eight Ball. We wrap up our episode with three new titles that are on streaming. We give you two listener recommendations that you guys have so kindly emailed to us at svu@filmspottingsvu.com. And one random film chosen blindly by number from our My Lists. Allison, you're going first on this episode. Are you ready to go?
I'm ready.
All right, let's start with three new releases.
Okay, first up is a sort of film, sort of miniseries. Called Little Can-Can, and it is currently streaming on Fandor, and I believe just got a theatrical release in New York, at least. It is the latest work from Bruno Dumont, who you may know from such films as 29 Palms and Flanders. It was produced as a miniseries and aired as a miniseries on television, but has been showing at festivals as one long feature. It's technically a comedy, which is an interesting idea if you've seen any of those earlier films from Bruno Dumont, who is not, they're not laugh riots, let's say. So this is a foray into a new genre for him. It is a murder mystery that opens with the discovery of a human, or human body parts at least, stuffed inside a cow in a small town in northern France, and goes on from there to all kinds of quirkiness. But this received a lot of acclaim and happens to be the number one film in Cahiers du Cinéma's top 10 of last year, which is a kind of provocative choice. So that is now available to stream in the U.S. on Fandor. Available to stream on Amazon Prime is The Congress, which I've talked about at more length on episode 74 of this podcast. But Ari Folman's half-animated Hollywood satire turned dystopian drama starring Robin Wright as a version of herself is definitely an imperfect film, but it's one that's really been lingering in my mind. And it's one that I would urge you to check out. It certainly looks nothing like any other film that's come out this year. And finally, new to Netflix is The Quiet Man, in which John Wayne plays an Irish-American man who travels to Ireland in the 1920s to reclaim his family's farm and falls in love with a beautiful redhead played by Maureen O'Hara with a fiery temper, and also clashes with her brother. This is a movie that's famous for its very long fistfight, but I think equally famous for its very charming romance. And I think beyond just showing this very idyllic small town, like small town Ireland, the romance between Maureen O'Hara and John Wayne is really lovable. They both have great chemistry and tons of misunderstandings, including her not understanding why he's not going to fight for her dowry, and for the thing that she was supposed to bring into this marriage, and with him harboring this dark past as a boxer who accidentally killed someone in the ring. It all works out in a way that's like kind of perfect without any broken bones, just a few pints shared. I like this one a lot. It is currently streaming on Netflix.
Oh, it's a great, great film. Yeah. All right, two listener recommendations.
Well, first up, we have one from Non, who writes, I have a penchant for animation, so I was thrilled to note that The Secret of Kells, the 2009 film, popped up on Amazon Instant. It's a truly wonderful story about identity, the value of art, and nature. It also expertly and beautifully juxtaposes the traditional and historical with the magical and ethereal. The animation is just so darn lovely and intricate, with all of it balanced and pieced together so intently. It's a true marvel of a film and a perfect one for lovers of animation. And so that's on Amazon Instant. I believe that director also has a new film that was out this year that might be an Oscar contender, which you might want to look up if you like that one. And then we have a recommendation from Phil in Leamington Spa in the UK, who writes, here in the UK, Netflix recently added a real treat, Jeremy Saulnier's wonderfully understated revenge movie Blue Ruin. It manages to subvert the genre in unexpected ways, making the hero character feeble and pathetic, incapable of even shooting someone at close range. The film builds slowly, filling in the backstory until the reason for the climactic standoff eventually becomes clear. It's well acted, nicely shot, and even has a great score. And that's streaming on Netflix in the US as well. And Matt and I are both big fans of that movie. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Phil.
Okay, and one random film from my list.
You gave me number 58, which is The Wall. I had to look this up when I don't remember adding this to my list. It's a 2012 Austrian-German drama written and directed by Julian Polzer and starring Martina Gedick, who is in The Lives of Others. It's about a woman who visits with her friends in their hunting lodge in the Austrian Alps. They go off to a nearby village. She discovers that she is cut off from all human contact by this invisible wall. So it's just her and the dog up on this mountain, and she can't get past the wall. And then she has to live in isolation with some animals off in the Alps. And that's a description.
I don't know
what made me add it, but it sounds certainly interesting. That's not a usual plot that you run into. All right, Matt, it's your turn. Are you ready?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, three new releases.
Okay, first up, a 70s cop movie par excellence, The French Connection, from director William Friedkin. Gene Hackman stars as NYPD detective Popeye Doyle, chasing after an international drug smuggling ring. The film is rightfully famous for three things: Hackman's great performance, the incredible subway and car chase, which is easily one of the best in movie history, and for that fabulous clothing line that comes from, I think, was inspired by exactly what Gene, right? Isn't that Gene Hackman wears all...
It's just all pork pie hats.
Yeah, I would love to see like a French Connection line inspired by the French Connection, or I would love to see someone like Photoshop French Connection clothes from 2015 onto Gene Hackman.
Yeah.
That'd be fantastic.
I sent a Tumblr.
Yes, I do. Ooh, I should get that Tumblr before someone else does and reap the traffic benefits. So that's The French Connection, which is currently streaming on both Netflix and Amazon Prime. Next up, streaming on Netflix, Tim Burton's directorial debut, Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Paul Reubens claims the next Pee-wee movie will be shot in 2015, later this year, supposedly. And rumors actually have it premiering on Netflix instead of going to theaters, which would be great for this show, actually, because we could review it. In the meantime, though, why not revisit the first Pee-wee movie, which holds up very well and follows the precocious Pee-wee in his quest to retrieve his stolen bicycle. Along the way, bars are danced on, breakfast is made in the most Rube Goldbergian fashion possible, and fun facts about the Alamo are shared. It's a delightful movie, maybe the most purely pleasurable one Tim Burton ever made. And I think that there's something to be said for the combination of Paul Reubens' surreal humor and very sunny disposition blended with Tim Burton's, you know, gothic imagery and very cynical attitude. I think that they've both done great things apart, but I don't know if they were ever better than they were together. So that's Pee-wee's Big Adventure, streaming now on Netflix. And finally, the best worst movie of 2014, streaming on both Netflix and Amazon Prime, I, Frankenstein. I thought it was funny. I really enjoyed it. Etc. Aaron Eckhart stars as Frankenstein's monster who winds up caught in a war between angels and demons and basically caught in a bad remake, off-brand ripoff of the Underworld franchise. The results are so stupid, Allison, they make Kenneth Branagh's Frankenstein look like Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. It is just unbelievably dumb. Let's hear a clip.
Nibirius has found a way to summon every demon you've ever descended.
What?
Possession. In bodies that have no souls.
Only the dead have no souls. What is the use of possessing a corpse?
There is none. Unless you can animate that corpse. Tiberius has been planning this for centuries. Victor Frankenstein just made it possible.
So if you want more sparkling dialogue like that, watch I, Frankenstein. And I am not sorry for recommending it because I really like I, Frankenstein, streaming on Netflix and Amazon Prime.
All right, two listener recommendations.
All right, let me start with this one from Andy in Philadelphia. He says, "Hey, Matt Nelson, my girlfriend Anne is a journalist who loves to introduce me to documentaries I never would have watched otherwise, as I'm usually more of a fictional movie guy. We watched one recently on Netflix that really hit me. The Waiting Room follows a group of uninsured patients at a public hospital in Oakland, California, as they try to receive serious medical attention over the course of a few days in the emergency room. It takes a verite, fly-on-the-wall type of approach, and rather than try to explain all the issues, it just follows the nurses, doctors, and patients all trying to do more with less." So that's The Waiting Room on Netflix, recommended by Andy in Philadelphia. Thank you, Andy. And here's a recommendation from Christy D. Christy writes, "I recently stumbled on a movie called Detention that I had never heard of before. At least I assume it never got an Australian release. The poster looks like a terribly schlocky horror movie, but its 4-star rating had me intrigued. Watching it, it's not really scary at all, but what it is hilarious, smart, and twisty. Think something akin to The Cabin in the Woods. You'll get to within 5 minutes of the end and think they can't possibly tie up all the various threads that have been woven together, but it pretty neatly manages to do that in a very satisfying way. The cast includes Josh Hutcherson and Dane Cook, and it's a really fun movie, and I hope you check it out sometime and maybe even talk about it on the show." So that's Detention, which is also streaming in the United States on Netflix. And that was a recommendation from Christy. Thank you, Christy.
All right. One from your My List.
You gave me number 23, my lucky number, 23. And this time, my number 23 is Fallen Angels by Wong Kar-wai. And I will make an embarrassing confession, Allison, and say I've never seen Fallen Angels. It's one of the only Wong Kar-wai movies I've never seen. The plot description from Netflix says a Hong Kong killer wants to get out of the game. And don't they all? But to do so, he must first overcome his romantic obsession with his rarely seen partner. Have you seen Fallen Angels?
I have.
Okay. Do I need to watch it tonight? Should I bump it up to number one on my list?
I really like it, but I mean, I don't think there's a sense of urgency to it.
Okay.
It's, you know.
I can stay where it is on the list?
Yeah. It's not my favorite Wong Kar-wai film, though. I think it's, as any of his films are, it's very enjoyable and extremely stylish.
All right. Well, I'll have to watch it at one of these. I do love Wong Kar-wai. I don't have an excuse. It's just one of the ones that slipped through the cracks, and that's why it's on my list here, as I haven't seen it yet. Let's get to our listeners' choice options for our next episode. We've got three very interesting ones here. It's going to be it's intriguing to see what wins here. Allison, you have the first one. What is it?
It's one that I just talked about. It is Little Can-Can, which is now streaming on Fandor. Bruno Dumont's comedy. And, you know, I feel like it's got such a small release in theaters, and Fandor is really its main platform, the streaming release on Fandor. And I feel like that really means it's something that we should cover. That and the fact that it's gotten so much praise and is apparently so weird. And people, some critics I really like, have really gone to bat for it. So I'm intrigued. I don't think the easiest watch. It's long because it's a miniseries. But I'm ready, and I want to watch a weird Bruno Dumont comedy. So that is on Fandor.
Okay, so option number two is available for rent on Amazon, iTunes, a bunch of other places. It is called The Kingdom of Dreams and Madness. It's directed by Mami Tsunade, and it is a documentary about Hayao Miyazaki, the animator. It's about his studio, Studio Ghibli. And it's also about the making of what he's claimed is his final film, The Wind Rises. And you've seen this movie already, right, Allison?
Yes.
I haven't seen it yet. I love The Wind Rises. It was one of my favorite movies of last year. Well, now 2 years ago, I guess, of 2013. I just adored that movie. But I'm not a total expert on Hayao Miyazaki. I've seen all his recent stuff. You know, like in the last 10 years, I've seen everything he's made. But I still haven't gone back and caught up with all of his really early stuff, which is supposed to be his masterpieces. So if this won, this would be a good excuse for me. Like, we could do a whole Miyazaki podcast, and I could go back and catch up with at least two of his earlier films that I haven't seen yet, that I could finally cross them off my list of embarrassing oversights. That would be great. And I've heard great things about the documentary as well, so I would love to watch that as well.
Yeah, and, you know, also covered not directly, because he kind of works in his own world, but the other co-founder of Ghibli, who made a movie that came out this past year, Princess Kaguya,
right,
which is one of my favorite movies of the year, that also, and it's like probably going to be his last film, so there's a real sense
end
of
an era,
end of an era to it, that if you're a fan of Ghibli, or even I think if you're bemused by Ghibli, which some people are, it's still,
or interested in hand-drawn animation,
it's a fascinating look at kind of process.
Yeah.
So one last pick, and it's another one that we've mentioned earlier in this podcast, Pride, which is available for rent on Amazon and iTunes, and is, as I mentioned before, you know, one of those feel-good films about British people getting out of their comfort zone and doing something slightly wacky and saving the day because of it. And like I said, this is a movie that has won a lot of people over. So it's one that I feel like we should talk about. And then maybe we can inflict on you a podcast about movies like The Full Monty and Kinky Boots and Saving Grace and Green Thumbs and Billy Elliot and the many other movies in this very successful genre.
Right, so maybe if you don't want to feel bad about the end of hand-drawn animation in Studio Ghibli, maybe you'll want to feel good about British people working together.
Exactly.
All right, well, which movie should we review on the next episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit? You can send your pick to svu@filmspottingsvu.com, or you can enter in the poll on the right-hand side of the page at filmspottingsvu.com. Your vote must be received by Monday, January 12th at noon. After that, we'll announce the winner on our Twitter account, @filmspottingsvu, and you'll have all that week to watch the film and then join us for our conversation on our next episode, which will be on or around Tuesday, January 20th.
FilmSpottingSVU.com is also where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of direct links to all the movies and TV shows we discuss on the episode. And the Film Spotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal. You can find more of Vince's work at vincevandal.com. And we will be back in 2 weeks with more recommendations and the review that you pick. And in the meantime, you can always follow us on Twitter @AllisonWilmore and @MattSinger. And you can follow the show @FilmSpottingSVU. That's where we announce the winner of each show's listener's choice and where we always share more streaming suggestions of things that are new and things that are recommended from you, the SVU listeners. For Film Spotting SVU, I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Matt Singer. Thanks for listening.